everybody. Welcome to another episode of What You Doin' Podcast. My name is Matt. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today, I'm talking to Andy Boyd, talking about his new game coming to crowdfunding for Zine Month, Midnight Muscadines. A really cool game of magic and mystery and wondrous worlds and, of course, jam. I want to thank Andy so much for sitting down to chat with me about this. It was a wonderful time, but let's get on with it. The interviews were great when you just had a notebook and you were talking to somebody in the street. That was great. That was easy.
What do you think about this? I've got four pages up.
Done. Print it.
I know. Print it. In the paper. You're published now.
A friend of mine loves to say, like, and he's more technically involved than I do. He's so smart with computers. He's worked in computers so long. He's like the worst mistake we ever made was teaching rocks to think. And I'm like, mm-hmm. I can't disagree with you.
I just left a 21 year career in IT. So yeah, I feel that.
Nobody knows more than guys in IT. We know how he's deep in it too. I always trust him. I'm like, no, I know you know more than me, and I trust everything you say.
So I've been a senior systems engineer and what they call a solutions architect, which is basically, you know, people come to you and they're like, I have this problem, and then it's my idea of figure out how to do it, you know, solve that technically. And there's so many times where I'm just like, we have this problem because of tech and we're trying to solve it with tech and we don't need any of it. Right. What if we just got rid of all of it?
Right. Well, you know, I get all these emails, and so I'm trying to, you know, what if you stopped getting emails? What if we stopped sending emails?
What if we just brought back the typewriter and in 3 weeks you'll get my letter?
Yeah. What if you went over and talked to him in his face and how quickly we could get the problem solved then?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah.
I did help desk in a number of roles for a good little bit. Yeah. And, you know, when the last place I worked, they would always be like, you know, reach out, give them a call, you know, get them on a remote session. And I was like, I'm just going to go talk to him. I'm just going to go talk to him and I'm going to get it solved in 5 minutes. Like, it's just so much faster.
I'm starting to do that now with the publishing piece too, because we'll be going back. And so I have publishing contracts with a company out of France, and they do localization and translations of our games and all this other fun stuff. And we'll be going back and forth talking about something, and we're at such different time zones where it's like a week later we've answered
one question. It takes forever,
And so occasionally I'm just like, hey, let me jump on a call. It'll be 8 a.m. my time, but that's fine. Like 3 p.m. your time. Let's just jump on a call and let's hammer this out. And we'll just sit there and we'll chat for an hour, and we'll have solved 8 things that would have taken us, you know, a month in emails to have, you know, actually figured out. I feel that.
Yeah, it's a thing I think people just don't think of. It's not, I don't think it's like some big societal ill like people try to do with all tech things. I think it's just like people just don't think about it. You know, they think of the convenience of an email, like, oh, I'll just send him an email. And I'm just like, you just call him and it'll take five minutes and it's done. You know,
I've actually started because all of our friends are in different time zones or across the country or the world or whatever. And so synchronously having a phone call with them these days is really tough. And so we've gotten to the point where we send voice messages back and forth. And so it's still asynchronous, right? Like, you don't have to respond right now. We don't have to all get together at the same time. But there's something about just talking to the person that is so much easier, and you're able to get a lot more across than, like, I'm going to send you a text or I'm going to send you an email, right? That talking bit still helps a lot.
What my partner and I are going to start doing with our friends, she's been talking with them because we have friends that live up in Asheville, and we have friends that live in Georgia, and we have friends that live in Ohio and a bunch of other places. And my best friend that lives in Ohio will send me voice messages on Discord on his way into work, which is great.
Because
it's great. It's just great to hear his voice and hear somebody talking. But what we're going to start doing is that sort of asynchronous thing, like you said, is instead of like just like, here's a little 1 minute video or voice thing about like, here's what I got going on. Here's, you know, here's what's happening with me. And just instead of like you said, can't sit down and have a voice call with 9 different people. But here's a little check in. Here's what I got. You know, like, oh, I'm on my way in because I got to do this, that, and the other. And then I'm going to go to the library and then I'm gonna, you know, read the rest of the night. And it's like, great, love this, love right. this idea.
This is you're still, you know, staying caught up. Not every message has to be some big important thing. Like, part of friendships was always just like, you're just chatting. Mm-hmm. You know, it's fine if you're not like, I have something to talk about. You can just be like, here's how my day's going. Here's what's going on. Right. And it's going to be real short or can be super long. Like, I've had to apologize to my friend because I'll be driving and just have the phone like on a mount and I'll just be talking to them while I'm driving. Totally lose track of time. And I've sent them a 6-minute long voice message. And I'm like, I am so sorry. But now you get to listen to all of this.
Right. Dude, put that on when you're driving. And then
right, exactly. Yeah, I just sent you an audiobook.
This is a secret podcast between the two of us.
That's exactly it.
And then I'm gonna like Cash App $5 requests, and then
right.
So speaking of podcasts, that seems like a great segue. Yeah, segue. Hi everybody, welcome to What You Doin' Podcast, the podcast where I talk to cool people about the amazing things that they make. Today I'm talking to Andrew with Pandion Games about Midnight Muscadines. Say hi, Andrew.
Hey, everybody. I'm Andy. I'm the lead designer and, I guess, founder of Pandion Games. And, yeah, I'm really excited to be here.
You're the first one that de facto makes you the founder.
That's true. Well, I've always been going back and forth on, like, do I call myself the founder? Am I the owner? I don't like saying that I'm the owner of Pandion Games, right? Mm. There's so many other people that like work on our games that like feels weird. I, you know,
I wonder if it feels so, like you're removed from the process.
Yeah right, like, oh, I just pull the strings and I'm like, no, like, I founded the company, like, there's a bunch of people that we work with, I consider them partners and part of the Pandion team, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've always had a hard time with it, saying like, yeah, I own Pandion Games. No, I founded it.
there's a lot of different things you can call yourself when it's, you know, mostly you.
It's all made up.
Right. Yeah. you could be chief architect. It's like, what do you architect? The games.
The games. Yeah.
You know, they have structures and formats, and that's, I've decided.
Sure.
You know, we talked a little bit at the beginning, like our history in IT. There's no goofier titles than working in IT.
Oh my gosh.
They'll come up with anything to call you to not give you a raise. Which is,
it's, or, you know, to justify a raise, which is crazy.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
They're like, well, you're going to be doing the same thing, but now we're going to call you this instead. And
you're,
we can give
lead.
You 5K more. And you're like, why? That makes no sense.
You're going to do the exact same things you were doing. You're now senior, whatever. And so now you get more. And it's like,
okay,
right, you can just,
however you justify it, right?
Could have just given me a raise. But so we're talking about Midnight Muscadines, the new book coming to Kickstarter. It's part of Zine Quest. I've been chatting with a lot of people about Zine Quest stuff. It's been very exciting.
So we are actually launching a little after Zine Quest.
Okay.
Make sure
that's fair.
To look for it during the like peak Zine Quest or piece that's going on. We had to push it because we are moving, so we pushed out a month. We'll be launching in April.
Oh, that's fair.
So
yeah,
it's close, but it's not quite.
Oh, that's been the only problem with Zine Quest, honestly, is that I like the focus. I like the limited run bit, but then it's like, now what if you want to do one in May? You know, and so it's there's a give and a take, you know, a give and a take with all things.
Yeah, and the thing is I love Zine Quest and I love Zine Month from the perspective of helping new creators do their first thing, whatever it ends up being. That's kind of actually how I got my start in doing printed materials or printed books with Zine Quest and Zine Month, and like the whole community's pulling in one direction, and so you're all kind of doing the same thing, you're all asking the same questions, and so people can put together resources for you. And that's exactly what we did. So I've done two Zine Months in the past, and now I've kind of shifted where I support people who are doing Zine Month. So we're doing a lot of talks on different Discords about how to actually go to print and how to market your games. And we're talking with a couple designers just through like DMs, like one-on-one, to do like how to actually design and write your first game. Because there's people that are like, I want to do Zine Month, but I don't even know how to start writing my first game, but I have an idea. And so like working with them of just like, okay, well, here's where you can start. Here's what some things to think about. So that's kind of how we do Zine Month now. is through supporting the community.
I like that, though. I've Andy's been doing a lot of posts on Blue Sky about, hey, are you doing a project? You know, post below. Here's a chance to promote and we'll share it out. And it's always a thing that's come up a couple times is just the incredibly strong sense of community in the TTRPG space, especially among creatives and, you know, people who, you know, very recently have had their start and, you know, I don't want to say like have a few things under their belt. That sounds dismissive, but, you know, people who are still like very, very fresh to the scene are immediately turning around and helping build that community up behind them. And it's amazing to see it every step.
More than to have more competition. I want as many zine designers and TTRPG designers out there making stuff, and I want them on the shelves next to our games. And, you know, I walked into a couple game stores recently and being able to be like, I know that person, I know that person, and I helped that person, and like I taught them how to, you know, actually go to print, and they, you know, it's what bleed is, and like that's so awesome to see that. Mm-hmm. And I think TTRPGs is one where we don't look at each other as competition. We look at each other as like co-creators, right? Like we're all creating within this space. Right. And I love that about TTRPGs.
Yeah, and it's been amazing to see during my time in the scene, like not to be old man about it, but like I remember the G+ days, mm-hmm. you know, watching the start of like the OSR movement and the sort of birth of the community away from the Forge and, you know, post Forge. And, you know, even now across whatever social media, it's just fantastic to see. Probably a bit that we'll get into when we talk a bit more about the book. I've referenced Fari RPGs with the Songs and Saga SRD, and seeing a bunch of people get excited about the SRD and start making stuff and sharing all of this stuff. And it's so exciting to watch those moments blow up on social media, and being able to see like stuff come together in real time. You know, like you see a post, yeah, and then a week later somebody's cool. Like, I wrote a game. Here it is.
They're like, yes, here. Yeah. Here's the artwork that I put together for it. And it was Photo Bash from Public Domain, or hey, I worked with this artist over here and, you know, he donated this artwork, or, you know, whatever, right? Like, and it just comes together all of a sudden. It's very cool to see.
It's always amazing. So let's talk about the general and the specifics of like creating the book. So Midnight Muscadines, why don't you give us a quick overview for people who might not be familiar? And then sort of, you know, talk about its origins.
Yeah, so Midnight Muscadines is our tabletop role-playing game. It's cozy dark. It's solo plus, so you can play it solo, duet, with a GM, without a GM. It supports all of those game modes. And it is about magical jams in a world of waning magic where the only source of magic left are these grapes called Midnight Muscadines that concentrate magic into their fruit. And you play as a marmiteer that goes out and collects these grapes from the Wilder Night, which is a land of twilight, and refine it into jam so you can preserve magic. And the magic can be used during the rest of the season when the grapes are not in season and ready to be picked. And there's a bunch of other stuff that has come out from the setting. There's a lot of really cool things to do. So that's kind of the pitch of the game is magical jams in a world of waning magic. And I'm actually very excited about it. I haven't been this excited about a game in a long time. Like, I love all of our games. This one, I'm just really stoked about. The origin is actually really cool. So you brought up Fari RPGs. So RP, the person behind Fari RPGs, him and I are really great friends. And he was running the Songs and Sagas game jam, and somebody made some joke about doing a jam-themed game jam. And I was like, let's go, let's do it. Like, I need to really just like go for it. And so the Drakes, from a couple of Drakes, they were like, let's do it together. Like, you do your own game, like your game that's jam thing, and we'll do ours. And I was like, yes, let's go. And so Midnight Muscadines was born from that, kind of. And this all took place, I think, on Threads is where this happened. Like,
I think I saw some of it on Threads, yeah.
Yeah, the Drakes called me out on Threads and they were like, we should do this. And I was like, all right, let's go. And then like a week later, we had our pitch and we had our first draft and they had written like 40,000 words. And
well, it's two of them. That's cheating.
Right. Well, it was two of them. And at the time, I wasn't full time game design yet. So like I was still working full time. And so it was just one of those like 2 hours in the evenings. I was doing this work. But I think it was like after the first week of working on it, I was like, oh, this is actually going to be a big game. Like, this isn't just like release it for fun and like, OK, that was good. And then move on to the next thing. I was like, this is cool. This is going to be a really cool game. And so I immediately reached out to my artist and my editor and some writers. And I was just like, I am assembling a team. Let's go. And everybody was immediately on board, which was fantastic. We had all just gotten off of finishing up Substratum Protocol, which was our last big game that we released. And so they were like, yes, we've been looking for the next project. So, yeah, we are on board. Tell us what you need. And so I think it was within like 2 weeks, this had gone from like a little silly game jam game to like a full-blown, I think we're at 130 pages now. We're going to be running a crowdfunding for it. We've got marketing plans. We're putting together a box set for it. Like, it's it's crazy. Yeah. Like, I just went all in. I was like, let's go.
That's very funny because I read the you know, sort of sample intro PDF, mm-hmm. and I was absolutely expecting something kind of small and light and focused around just the idea of like, you know, kind of like goofy Magic Jam game, you know, and just like, ha ha, this is a game about jam. And then I started looking through it. I was like, oh no, this is a game. We're in it. This there's,
yeah,
we got tables. We've got, yeah,
we hired, Patrick from The Soloist, the person that like writes and has been building the solo TTRPG community. We hired him to write the tables for Midnight Muscadines to be like, we want these focused on solo players. Like, GMs can use the tables too, obviously, mm-hmm. but like in order to support solo play. And he was like, I've got you. Like, I am so excited to be on board for this. And so like, yeah, it was, yeah, when you go through and you're like, this has got tables and it's got character creation and like actual like abilities and resolution, like it's a whole thing.
It opens with like four pages of setting. And I was like, all right, I wasn't. And it's great. Yeah. This is not me saying anything bad about it. I was just like, oh wow, I was expecting like a 6-page, you know, kind of goofy right. thing. And it's like, oh no, we're in it. We're bought in.
Yeah, the 6 pages is where it started, and then I think what it was is, as I was writing this, all of our recent games, probably the last 4 or 5 games I've released, are very focused, right? There's a beginning, middle, and end. There is a specific story that you're trying to play, and a Substratum Protocol is a perfect example, right? Like, you're going to delve the depths, you're going to solve the problem, you're going to save the world or end it, right? And then it's going to be over. And you can tell different stories in that, but Midnight Muscadines, as I was designing it, was like, this is our open world. You can play adventures in it. You can run campaigns in it. You can do all sorts of cool stuff. You can write expansions for it. You can write more ingredients and magic for it. Like, people can really sink their teeth into it and continue to building on what we're building on. And that's what got me really excited is, you know, we've kept it simple, like whole Pandian flavored piece of like keeping the rules simple. So all the summary fits on like one spread, right, of pages. So all the rules can be condensed down to that one spread. And then also we removed heavy focus on combat. So there's still conflicts, there's still encounters, there's still challenges to overcome. But it's not like you're seeking out the +2 sword, right? Mm-hmm. But this was the first one that I think I really got right with. You can still do a lot of interactions. There can still be danger. You can still go up against adversaries. But it doesn't bog down into tactical combat, right? And I think that's one of the big things that has me super, super excited about this is being able to do those different things.
Well, it's a tricky balance, right? Especially when you have a game that, you know, focuses solo, but has the ability to play more. And, you know, you want something that you can have something that's a little more detailed with conflicts and things, but you don't want something where it's like, all right, here's the map and I'm here behind the tree. And then we gotta count squares or whatever.
Yeah, and one of the things that I was trying to overcome is the moment you put in, you know, stats on a weapon and you put in, like, different things like cover. Like, oh, if you have cover, then X and Y and Z. It's things like that. Or this spell has a range of 30 feet. You're immediately back into tactical combat, right? And everything shifts. And so this system actually still stays away from that while still giving players the ability to strategize about what they want to do. So, for instance, we don't have HP at all. When you go up against an adversary, you're making checks against their difficulty, right? So you're rolling your dice, and you can use items and spells to add dice to your dice pool, and that's how you quote-unquote attack, right? You're like, oh, I want to use this magic spell in order to do this, and I'm going to try to overcome the enemy in this way. Mm-hmm. And then you put that pool of dice together and you roll against their difficulty, and you need a certain number of successes to ultimately overcome them. So if they have, let's say, a difficulty of 8, I can roll an 8 and overcome one of the checks that I need, right? And now they're quote unquote, you know, halfway done if you only need 2 successes. But what I think's really cool about the system, and I'm digging in deep on the mechanics because I've been so excited about these mechanics. I've been eating, living, and breathing these for like 3 months. but what's really cool about the checks is, you know, if you put together something really, really amazing, so say the target number is 8 again that you need to beat, and instead you roll a 16, that's 2 successes against them. And you could just be done with that adversary completely in one roll because you were so grandiose with what you've done. Mm. Right? And so that concept is still there. That's like rolling your nat 20 and like doing 80 damage and then you just wipe them out, right? Like,
right.
That concept is still there, but because you don't necessarily have to use weapons against an adversary, you can say, hey, what I'm trying to do is overcome them by, you know, entangling them and trapping them so they can't take any more actions. And that's what I do to overcome the adversary. All you're doing is trying to get, you know, your successes to do that. And once you claim those successes, it's done. And you've accomplished what it is that you're trying to do against that adversary. So it also opens up more than just, you know, fighting and killing something.
Right.
Which I love. And that took a lot of work. That took like 5 revisions. My editor was like, I'm tired of this. And I was like, I know, we're almost there. And he was great through the whole thing and provided so much great feedback. But yeah, it took us a long time to like find a good balance for these checks and how combat would work and challenges and, you know, just general gameplay as well.
It's been interesting to see, like you mentioned having conflict without HP. It's been interesting to see a lot of different designers kind of solve the same problem over the last few years and come with a lot of wildly different solutions, and it's great because it's like, you know, how do we show conflict, not necessarily violent conflict, but, you know, conflict, disagreement, whatever, in a way that isn't just numerical. You know, it's like, oh, I did -5 against whatever.
Yeah.
And so it's always interesting to see people flex their muscles in that direction to say, like, okay, what makes sense for this sort of game? How does this look? How does this whatever?
I was going to say, when you get right down to it, I think the thing that people like about tactical combat with the numbers is there's that tension of like, oh, am I going to win? Oh, I'm getting close. And then that release of like, oh, I was successful, or oh, I, you know, got killed myself. And so it's like, well, how do we replace that so it's not such a slog? Because combat really has become a slog these days and taken away from the, like, quote unquote, fun things you can do. But you still want that tension and release of, like, oh, you're in danger and, you know, can you overcome the adversary that's in front of you? And then it happens, right? And so, like, how do you build that in the mechanics without using just numerics and mathematics?
I always think of, like, my partner playing games, you know, like, I like playing strategy RPGs and JRPGs and, you know, tweaking every number as perfectly as it is. And she plays, you know, not exclusively, but, you know, farming sims and things like that, where, like, she's like, I'll attack the monster, but I'm going to do it when I know I'm going to win. And it's very different ways to approach effectively the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think this game takes that second approach, right? Where it's like, well, you're not hitting him in the head with a sword, you know, like you said, like, it could be you put him in a net. It could be you just talk to him and you convince him not to do it. I appreciate games that put in the effort to put those on the same level, right? Yeah. It's not this whole other thing that you need to do if you want to convince, if you just want to talk to him. It's not this whole other thing that you need to do if you want to, you know, put him in a net or, you know, restrain them somehow. It's the same thing. It's just how do you want to flavor it? How do you want to describe it?
Yeah. And the nice thing is, for what we have set up here, is there are still those dials for people that want to strategize. How do you want to use impact dice? We have cards. So when you fail a check, you can collect cards. You can then turn around and burn those cards to add additional dice to make your impact greater. So, you know, if you're going to use a magic spell and it's a, you know, D6 added to your check with this magic spell, you can burn a card and now you're going to roll 2D6, right? But cards can be used for multiple things. And so it's like, okay, do I use my card to do this thing over here? Or do I want to save it for my check? I've got a D6 die associated with this item. I could improve that item. Does that make sense? You know, and so there's a lot of different little things that, if you want to, you can sit there and tweak and maximize and figure out the best strategy. And there's still that sense of danger where you could just go in and be like, okay, well, I'm going to roll these two dice and we're going to see what happens. That's what I'm trying to accomplish. Or you can go, hold on a second. And this is kind of metagaming, which is totally fine. Like, I think that's part of games. You can be like, hold on a second. How do I do this in one roll? What's my best chance? Like, I want to superhero this thing. And how do I do that? I've got three cards in my hand. I've got this over here and I've got this over here. This is what I'm trying to do. And I'm going to burn these cards and I'm going to roll all of these dice. And we're just going to trounce. And, like, that option is still available to the players that want to do that, right? And think more mechanically. But if you want to ignore all of that, and you just want to be like, yes, I've got this cool item. I've got, you know, the Rope of Esoterra, and it can do this thing, and it's a D6 die. So I'm going to roll my D6 with this attribute and roll those together, and yeah, I got a success. Cool. Here's what happens. Mm-hmm. You can do that too, right? So you can kind of... My big thing is I want the crunchy bits of the game to be there for the people that enjoy it and can be completely ignored for the people that just really do want to focus on the narrative aspects of it.
Yeah. And those are the two moods I often find myself shifting between when playing games. Yeah. It's just like, I don't know, man, here's some dice. I think I did it. Cool. And then, like, sitting there for 10 minutes during someone else's turn, like, all right, so if I use this thing, that's a six. That'll be like 4 or 5. And then, you know.
Right. And, well, and that's you playing the game while the other person's taking their turn. Like, you're still playing at that point, which is great. Like, that's what I want. That and our leveling mechanics. There's actually two leveling mechanics in the game. And they both have you being able to tweak your character in different ways and also potentially tweak the greater world, depending on which leveling you're doing at a certain time. So there's your standard experience. You know, as you are successful at things, you gain experience, and you can turn that experience in to add modifiers to different things, or to increase your resilience, which is your HP, essentially. but you can also gain renown. And renown is like accomplishing tasks, greater tasks, narrative tasks. You get renown for that. And then you can spend that renown to do things like get new abilities or influence guilds. Guilds actually play a decent sized part in this game. You can change alliances. You can equip yourself so you can actually expand your inventory slots, because you start with a limited number of inventory slots. So you can be like, well, I actually want to carry more items. Those items have dice associated with them. I want to level up the items, and then I want to like carry more of them so I can do more things. Mm-hmm. You know, that's all in there with the leveling mechanics that we've put in. And you could just be like, you know what? No, I just want to go help a guild. Like, I don't want to focus on me. I don't want like my plus one modifier to an ability or anything. I want this narrative track. I want their agenda to advance. And you can do that, right? Mm-hmm. And that's that balancing the two sides of narrative versus mechanical.
And it's really easy for the GM to respond to either thing, you know, because there's no background numerical advancement. You're not foregoing one for the other at a detrimental point. You're just like, no, I want to do this narrative thing more than I want this mechanical thing. And it's like, okay, cool. Well, we won't advance mechanically. So yeah. It's not like stuff is, you know, magically getting harder in the background.
Right. And even if things, you know, you do come up against an adversary that is very powerful for some reason, what we've kind of built into the system is if you fail multiple times, you collect cards into your hand. You can then use those cards to roll more dice on a given check. And so through failure, success in the future is more likely. Mm. So even if you do become mechanically underpowered, you're going to fail a few times, you're going to collect a bunch of cards, and then you can, you know, start adding dice that way. And so it tries to keep itself balanced, where it's like, if you're a mechanically weak character, that's fine, we're going to give you the tools to still have successes, you're just going to have to work harder for them. And then if you're a mechanically powerful character, you know, you're still on the same footing narratively as the other characters.
It's a thing I think a lot about with games that are not, you know, D20 attack a guy and do hit point damage, is like, what does losing look like? Because if we look at a lot of media, it doesn't feature characters losing it with, you know, some specific exceptions or, you know, sort of intentional choices. You know, the thing I always think about, And of course it's this, because of course it is. Like, I always think about Goku, because like Goku loses, but it's not like Goku loses and it's just like, mom, I guess I lost. All right, whatever.
Oh, I guess he's dead now.
Yeah. Right. Like, no. Yeah. And even a great example, even when Goku dies, as it happens all the time, yeah, like other things happen, other things change, other things shift. He gets stronger and comes back, or something else happens.
Yep.
And so I've started like noticing that in games, of just like, what does that loop look like? You know, what does that continuation look like? Of like, okay, you lose. Now what? How does the system react to that? How does the world react to that? Is there a meaningful change?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, so we do a couple things. So, for instance, losing in like an OSR sense would be losing all your hit points, you make your death saves, and then you're dead, right? That's ultimately losing. And you might lose a combat because you, you know, retreat or whatever. But one of the things that we say as in the resilience section is that if you drop to zero, you're probably going to take a condition. And conditions are these narrative effects that get applied to you. But what it means when you go to zero depends on the circumstances as to what you were doing when that was happening, right? If you were, you know, trying to go up against a glow bear and, you know, you got electrified and then you faint, right? You could just be like, oh, I fainted. Oh, I got dragged back to, you know, I regained consciousness when you get dragged back to its den. Or, you know, if you're going up against other adversaries, you know, like a group of, you know, thieves or something, they just take your stuff and leave, right? Like, mm-hmm. You're not interested in, like, you know, stabbing you through the heart. They might be, depending on your GM or your play style, but it doesn't necessarily mean you die. Mm-hmm. All right. It means you're now at a narrative disadvantage. Something bad happens. What you were trying to accomplish didn't go the way you were hoping it would. And you wake up, you know, 3 hours later, and, you know, maybe somebody found you unconscious in the forest and they drag you back to the local tavern and you're, you know, being healed. But now you have an injury condition that gives you a limp. And if you try to run away, you're like, oh, I'm going to try to, you know, attempt to flee from this situation, blah, 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 blah. You might do it at a disadvantage, or the difficulty is harder for you. Mm-hmm. So conditions can like add, I think it's +1 or +2 to a DR check. So if the GM goes, oh, hey, because you're waterlogged, covered in water, because you fell into a pond, and now you're in the cold, your checks are going to be at +2 DR from what they normally are because you're freezing, because mm-hmm. you're waterlogged, right? Like, so that's what conditions apply to. And losing resilience might apply a condition to you. And it might be a long-term thing where you have to go to a doctor to get it removed, or you have to go to an apothecary or something to that effect, right?
Yeah.
But I always think it's more interesting than dying.
Right. It like you said, it makes sense, you know, determined by what's happening. Like, if you're having an argument with somebody and you lose the argument, you're not going to die.
Yeah.
You know, you don't explode, you know, but like you said, you might take some sort of condition that like, yeah, now people in the village don't respect you because like you were kind of a jerk, and or they don't think you're not a good leader or something like that, depending on the situation. And so easy. I've really been interested in seeing the ways that games deal with failures just as much as successes, because I think an interesting way to deal with failure is more kind of exciting than an interesting way to deal with success, because like, okay, success, I won. That's great. That's what I get, is I succeed.
Yeah. I think the interesting pieces of like storytelling and playing games is the failures, right? Like when you get that, you know, crit one, that's exciting. Cause you're like, oh, something bad's going to happen. What is it? Right. Yeah. And so building that into a system in a way that's, sometimes a little bit more forgiving, but allows for, you know, the GM or the solo player to be like, what bad does happen? And I'm not dreading it because I don't, you know, I'm not just going to die and lose this character that I care about, mm-hmm. but something interestingly bad occurs. And yeah, I mean, you're heroes of a story. I don't think you should just die or get wiped out in negative situations. There are some games where that's absolutely the case, and that's why you build three characters at the beginning and they go through a life path and only one of them survives, and that's a gameplay method too. That's not what this game is.
That's the bit you sign on for at the beginning, is you say, I know what I'm getting myself into.
Absolutely.
I saw a recent article on Polygon about a TTRPG, and In it, there was Loot by Spencer Campbell, who's been experimenting with a lot of diceless stuff, and so the comment was something along the lines of like, I don't know if I'm interested in a system where failure isn't an option, and I kind of wanted to just leave a comment of like, buddy, failure is always an option. Like, if it's the problem between like the short description of the article versus how it's probably described in the game, because I've read a couple of Spencer's other things. But I think a very interesting thing happens when you manage to understand the separation between the character and the narrative, and that the narrative is not the story of my character, that the narrative is the narrative and my character exists in the narrative. You might have multiple characters in the narrative, and that the narrative continues regardless of what happens to your character. And so what should happen to your character is the most narratively interesting thing, because that's what makes an interesting narrative. You know, I think about all the times playing with my friend Jordan, who will just try to get himself in as much trouble as possible. Right. And, you know, overly pain or anything about it, but it's like, I want to go talk to the mayor about this. It's like, you want to go talk to the mayor? That's going to go terribly. And he's like, or it's going to go great.
We're going to find out.
Yeah. Right. It's either going to go really good or really bad. Either way, good time.
Yeah. Yeah. And diceless systems are really tough because usually things like dice is where the drama is injected,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. It's a very different like mindset, yeah. even. You have to approach everything very differently.
Yeah. And we have a diceless system. It's unreleased. And one of the hardest pieces in there was, okay, how do we get players to, you know, take drama or take complications when, you know, there's no random chance, right? We're not rolling dice on anything. And it's a token-based system. And so one of the ways that characters gain tokens is by taking complications and basically saying, hey, I want to do this thing. And instead of spending 3 tokens in order to do it, I'm going to take a minor complication and basically fail at this task. So I gain 3 tokens instead.
Mm.
And so that's kind of how we got around adding that. But, you know, that's a super fresh field of design. Yeah. You know, we've been designing with dice for, what, 50, 60 years now.
Right.
And doing token design and card-based design is fairly fresh. So I'm definitely excited for anything. Anybody doing diceless design is, I love reading their stuff.
It's a thing I talk a lot about. I've done a lot of TikToks about TTRPGs and like engaging with TTRPGs and thinking about TTRPGs and all of that. Shocker, I have a podcast. I also talk a lot on other social media platforms. Who'd have thought? And one of the big things that I've said and I've seen dozens of people say is read other games, play a lot of games. Like even if you're like, this is my favorite game ever, that's great. Read the complete opposite game to that you can find. Like if you love D&D, read Amber Diceless. You know, and it happens every time. It's a thing that I feel silly saying because it happens all the time. I'll read a game and I'll go, wow, I'd never, wow, you know, and it's so amazing to think about like engaging with mechanics differently, rolling dice differently, even just something as simple as like assigning a difficulty value differently. Mm-hmm. The way it works, I like I was chatting with Andrew in a previous episode, and then for Midnight Muscadines, I like the idea of there being codified difficulty values,
mm-hmm.
that are like, okay, this is easy, normal, hard, really hard, that then might have modifiers based on things that are happening, but that it's in the open, it's obvious, it's known to everyone at the table, and then it's part of the discussion of, should this apply? Should this not apply? Do we want to change what we're doing to not have that mechanical effect? And it's something that seems very, very simple now, but we're kind of just now getting to it only, you know, over the last couple of years.
Yeah. And I mean, because when I used to run my games back 5-6 years ago using D&D rules and Pathfinder rules, and that was all we had been exposed to. And yeah, like you hid your checks, like what's the DC? Well, you don't get to know that. You're mm-hmm. going to find out by guessing, like you're going to have these ranges like, okay, I think it's 12. So I need to be rolling over this. So I'm going to use this, right? Like you would do that. Whereas we're starting to see more along the lines of, this is how hard this is going to be to accomplish. And because of these other situational facts, it'll be harder or easier. How are you going to overcome this? Or do you even want to try to overcome this? And I think part of it is the characters in the world aren't dumb.
Mm-hmm.
They're seeing the situation and, you know, they're able to make an assessment of just like, okay, I'm going to have to put forth this much effort, or, oh, hey, this is going to be this hard. They can see that, right? And I think by letting the players know mechanically what that difficulty is, they can then translate it into their characters looking at a situation and assessing it and being like, oh, this is
oh, actually, this is a lot. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, and I like that. I think it's a really good shift that we're seeing there.
I like to talk about like the meta of TTRPGs and design as a whole sometimes, because it's exciting. It's hard not to, especially getting the chance to talk with, you know, people who are making it, people who are you know, putting it down on paper. And I you know, speaking about DCs and stuff, I think it's great as a player as well, because, you know, you mentioned like playing D&D and Pathfinder. Like, there was nothing, I played Pathfinder for a good number of years, there was nothing more annoying than like I want to do this, and it's like, okay, you can do it, and then it's like, oh, the DC's like way high. It's like, I wouldn't have bothered.
Yeah.
If we had had any sort of concept of that, I wouldn't have wasted my time. Like, right. more than I failed at the table, this was 10 minutes. I could have, we didn't need to.
Well, and I think it's part of it is just like, when we talk about tabletop role-playing game, the meta aspect's the game part of it,
mm-hmm.
right? We don't like belittle anybody playing board games for metagaming, because they're interacting with the rules. That's the point.
Mm-hmm.
That's the game. And so with tabletop games, like, yes, we don't want to, like, we still want a cool story, and we still want a cool narrative. We want to think about what the characters are going to do in this situation and what they would do in this situation. But there's still that game aspect. And so for players to know the, you know, oh, I've got these dice and I can do this, and okay, I'm trying to beat this number in order to accomplish this task narratively, that's the game part, and I think we should definitely encourage that.
Yeah, I had a good run a little bit ago about metagaming, and like, metagaming isn't bad, actually. And anytime you think metagaming is bad, you're wrong.
Yeah, and I mean, like, at some point, you're always thinking about the rules. That's why they exist, right? Your whole character sheet is rules.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're making choices about your character based upon the rule set that's in front of you. So, you know, in many ways, you're always going to be metagaming in some way, because you're always thinking about the rules in addition to the narrative. I think really the only time it gets detrimental is if you're only making mechanical choices and don't care about the narrative at all,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's when you start doing like, well, I've got a +5 here, so I'm going to use this attribute. Well, why would your character use strength in this situation?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but it's my highest attribute.
Right. Okay. That's +5. So let's me. It's like, okay, let's.
Right. This and you're like, okay, hold on. Like,
it's not really what we're doing. Know, so, okay.
Yeah. So that's really the only time where I'm like, maybe not to that extent. Maybe not to that extent. Yeah. But if they can justify it, they're like, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to crush the wooden beam to show my strength in order to intimidate them, and that's how I'm going to try to persuade them to follow me. And you're like, okay, roll strength.
There we go.
Right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We got there.
Yep. Yeah.
We just had to get there. We tried a little bit. Boom. Great. Good yep. job, everybody.
Exactly.
So shifting to sort of personal history, what was your what's your kind of history with TTRPGs? How did you get started playing? And kind of the thing that I'm always interested in, I've been bad about asking, but it's the moment I'm always interested in is, what was, maybe not the moment, because it was probably 100 different moments, but what was the moment you went from I'm playing TTRPGs to I'm designing TTRPGs?
Oh yeah. So I got my start, I was invited to a Pathfinder game long time ago, and ended up playing 2 or 3 sessions of that, and was like, well, I need to run my own game now, because it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I started running my own game of D&D. I ran 2 different games for 3 years. And then I discovered Tales of the Loop, and I discovered Quest RPG, which was basically just this like really super streamlined D&D 5e style game, which was mm-hmm. I thought freaking amazing. I love their ability trees in there. So I started really looking into that, and playing some of those games. I played some other games like Dread with the Jenga tower. Mm-hmm. It's freaking amazing. That really opened up my eyes as to like what you could do with TTRPGs. So that's kind of how I got my start, and I was very like D&D mindset focused when I first started designing games. And it was my development editor, because I had basically found and hired a really great development editor when I went to design my first game. And I basically said, hey, I don't know what I'm doing. I have this idea. Would you also consider this like a mentorship? I'm willing to pay a little extra per word kind of thing. I'm not just looking for development feedback. I'm trying to learn how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember like one of his comments was to the effect of, why, like, you're just thinking in D&D terms. You just told me this game's not about combat, it's about investigation, but the majority of your book is laying out tactical combat. Why?
Mm.
And so that really, like, I was like, oh, hey, wait a minute, we don't have to do that? Like, we don't have to plan games in a way where you, like, okay, well, I've got to define what's cover, and I got to define these items, and I got to define their, you know, their die ratings and all, and you're like, you don't have to do that. This isn't a game about combat. It's about investigators mm-hmm. on a moon. Like, you don't, there's no combat. I was like, okay, fair. But what actually spurred me to start designing was I was doing adventure design for Quest and player aids for Quest. And that's kind of how I first started thinking about really design aspects of like what makes like a story.
Mm.
And then we started living in an RV full time around COVID, and I realized I didn't have a game that you just sit around and play around a campfire. Everything needed a flat surface, it needed good lighting, it needed, you know, a place to roll dice, it needed to be able to, you character sheets you had to write down, all sorts of stuff, right? And I was like, I need a game that I can play around a campfire. And so I designed my first game called Storyteller, a campfire narrative game. It's still for sale today. Like, it needs an update. it was my first game, and it was out of kind of necessity, where I was like, I'm going around to these campsites and I needed something that I could teach somebody really quick, and we could just sit around the campfire and basically play a game in our camp chairs.
Mm-hmm.
And what's a resolution mechanic look like when I don't know the materials that anybody has. And so I devised a system for that and different things, and ended up laying it out and, you know, talking with that development editor again to kind of tweak it. And then I set it up to print. And so that's kind of how I first got into it. It was kind of out of I couldn't find anything to do what I needed it to do. And so I made my own, and the rest is kind of history. The bug bit me and I never stopped.
Necessity is the mother of invention, as they say. Yep. And that's a hell of a reason too. I was speaking with a friend of mine, and she said that was basically the impetus for, you know, her designing. I don't think it was her first game, but it, like one of her other games was, she played another game and she was like, this was fun, but this isn't what I thought we were getting into. And so she made that game.
Yeah.
And she was like, this is the game that was what I thought we were playing. And so now we're there. And I was like, there you go.
Yeah. I thought the thing that spurred me to actually like form Pandion was I had put up one of the adventures for Quest that I had written up on itch.io, and I put it up for free, like pay what you want. Like, I was like, whatever. Like, this is just free stuff. And within a day, somebody had paid me $2 for it. And I was like, oh, people will pay for this.
To pay what you want, you're like, wait a minute.
People pay, right? Instead of just taking it for free. And I was like, wait a minute. And so, you know, for the longest time, I just did digital releases and like would yell on Twitter about it and that kind of stuff, which was a great way to get going, because I also had no clue what I was doing. Like, I was not in a way to make like a formal game at that point. I was still very much just playing around. So like a digital release for $5, fine. If somebody doesn't like it, that's Right. They're only out $5, not $40 for a physical book.
Right, right.
But yeah, it was that moment where like I opened my phone. I was like, oh, I have an itch.io notification. And I was like, ooh, somebody paid me $2. Why would they do that? Was that a mistake? Did they hit the button on accident? Like, I remember thinking that. And I was like, maybe I could do this as a business, you know, after putting in some more work and effort. But the idea that somebody would pay for an adventure was new to me. Like, I had never thought that somebody would do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very like eye opening. It was itch.io. And that was a very cool moment, honestly, looking back.
I love itch. It's been amazing just the last couple of years, and I feel like it has directly and indirectly like grown the independent like TTRPG scene. Like, obviously directly with having bundles and stuff and helping people with reach and having stuff so available, but then I think also just it being there has helped people realize like, oh, I could just make a game. Like you said, I could just mm-hmm. make a thing and put it there, and then it's there. You know, I feel like it's removed that first important barrier, which is just putting it somewhere that someone can look at.
Oh, absolutely. And it's one of those, and I tell new designers this all the time, but get something out. It doesn't have to be the best thing you've ever made.
Mm-hmm.
But finish something and put it up on itch and just have it in the world. And it will go from there, right? And you can go back and you can make changes to it and you can make tweaks, right? So just because you've put a game out on itch doesn't mean it's static and it can never change again.
Right.
Make updates as you get better, like that kind of stuff. I think another thing about itch that makes it so powerful is, unlike DTRPG, itch doesn't ask you to go into contracts or be exclusive printing or you know, any of that stuff. They're just like, hey, you want to throw up some digital files? Cool. You want to make a cool page? Done. Have fun. And that's it. And it's great.
Hey, would you pay us like a little? Okay, right? No. That's fine.
And you can just be like, nah. And they're like, yeah, that's fine.
All right,
like,
yeah, no. Fine. Sure. Rock on.
I mean, when we first got going and we were only making like $2 sales, right?
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely was like, no, itch. Like, don't take any of my money. Like, I'm only making $10 a month. I was like, don't
take any. It's only $2, man. It's not worth any of our times.
Right, exactly. And now we do, I think I do 10% is what I have it set to on itch, which is great that mm-hmm. you can kind of set that. Because I think DTRPG takes like 30%, which is a lot.
I think that's right. Yeah, which...
yeah.
I was talking with the same designer friend of mine, and I don't know how we got talking about it, but you know, talking about putting stuff up on DriveThru, and mm-hmm. I brought up the topic. I was like, well, just increase the price based on the cut that they take. So just whatever, just add, you know, if you want to make $5 on your game, price it so that when they take their cut, it's $5.
So the hard part about DTRPG I found is that people do not like spending money on DTRPG, or they're very specific of what they think everything should be worth.
Mm.
And so, like, I'll put something up on itch.io and something on DTRPG, they'll be the exact same price, and nobody will touch the DTRPG one. Tons of people will pick up the itch on itch.io. And then only when it goes on sale to like $1. Right, through like the DTRPG like automatic sales or whatever, it'll get included and be like, hey, you made a sale of, you know, Whispers in the Walls for $2.25. And I was like, oh, okay, so that's the level that you guys are willing to spend out, and that's totally fine.
I think it's just a totally different it's a different vibe, and it's exciting to see a different community and sort of different approach come about, because like, also, you know, in the video game space, itch has been incredible for a lot of same reason. It's so easy for somebody to make, I mean, as easy as it is for anything else, to make an indie video game, you know, a small thing with Unity or Godot or whatever, and then just, boop, it's on itch now. There you go. It's $10.
Yeah. Yep, and you don't have to go through contracts and approvals, and they, you know, playing the game, and the oh, did you get your ESRB rate? You don't have to do any
right.
of that.
It's just right there.
There are some controls, obviously. Like if you're making an adult game, you have to specify that, or you will get in trouble on it. But otherwise, if you're, you know, if you're just like, hey, I'm going to do this thing, and oh, hey, it has, you know, these tags, you know, sensitivity tags associated with it, they're like, okay. You've told us, like, it's up there now. We'll hide it from people that don't want to see that kind of content. And that's it. That's all the approval you need. And that's so much easier than, oh, submit this and write these, you know, submit these contracts and this percentage, and then this person will reach out to you from right. Steam and all this stuff, right? Like,
give us this, like, put these images and these sizes and this thing.
Yeah.
And
oh yeah. Itch.io is just like, hey, you want your page to look like crap and don't use the correct size images? That's fine.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah,
that's you, man.
Sure. Yep. Is that the image you want to use? All right. I'll put it there. And I think that's great because a lot of people have leaned into that. I was looking at a page for a game the other day, and the comment section was spinning over the page. I couldn't follow them because the comments were over the button. And I had to sit there and wait. And I was like, this is kind of frustrating, but also
pretty cool.
All right.
Itch.io is the only place that I know where you can request and gain access to the CSS of that page. So, like, we have
drive-thru's not letting you change nothing.
Oh no.
Drive-thru's not letting you do nothing.
So, like, I've gone through and I've been like, okay, I want the banner to actually span the full width of the page, and I want the columns to be different. I want this to be this color and do this, though this and this, right? All through the custom CSS access. And you can't do that on any of these other platforms. Mm-hmm. They will not let you. It's actually one thing that I want to talk to BackerKit about, to be like, hey, my campaign page, like, don't give me full CSS access by any means, but like, if I want to make the background, like, not the center column, but the background purple to match my theme, can I do that, please? Like, that's a pretty basic thing. Well, on Itch.io, it's a basic thing. Everywhere else, they won't let you touch it. And yeah, like, I think that's one of the big selling points of Itch, is they're just like, come have fun.
It's always make great. It's always great. You know, I see on Blue Sky, or I read an article, or I, you know, see somebody share something and I go, oh, this looks cool. And I go and I look at the page and I go, yeah, this looks really cool. I wonder what else they've done. And I click to the, like, view all page, and it's just this fully custom, like, you can tell that they have sat down and they want this page to reflect their vibe as a designer, the vibe of their games and all of this. And I'm just, it's always incredible. It's just like, yes.
Yeah. It makes me so excited. We spent a bunch of time on ours to do, like, custom buttons. Cause I was like, how do I show bundles on my dashboard, my landing page on Itch.io? Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, we don't really have a way to display those. And I was like, well, can I make my own images with rollover and links to the bundle as, like, a button? And they were like, yeah, we don't care. You do whatever you want. And I was like, fine, okay. But yeah, like,
yeah, sure.
It's like a really nice GeoCities, is what it is.
RIP
really
GeoCities.
Nice GeoCities and Angel Fire. Yep.
Oh man.
Good times.
We were, this might get cut. We were talking. I was talking with a friend of mine the other day, and I was like, kids these days don't know YTMND, and they don't, and the culture is lesser for it. Like,
yeah, right. I know. Yeah. Well, one thing I am grateful for is not having to worry about auto-playing music
and
streaming animations on random pages.
We had to go through some hell. We found out what was wrong.
Now, I will say the internet was more interesting.
Yeah.
The internet was more interesting from just an artistic perspective. Like, going back to Itch, I think that's exactly why Itch is doing so well, is because every page is different. You click into a game's page, you have no idea what you're clicking into.
Right. Who knows, like, what's going to happen?
GIFs playing. They could actually have embedded, you know, like, audio files and playlists. You can do that. The spinning comment section, like, you can do that. And I think more places should allow that, just because it makes the internet such a fun place.
Mm-hmm. It's saying this is not some, you know, standardized mall storefront that has to look nice. Yeah. And the column has to be 75 pixels in this shade of red for trademark. Yep. and you know, branding purposes.
Yeah.
It yeah. can look like whatever, because this is your page.
Right. Exactly.
That was a nice segue. I like that. I love talking about itch. So I wrote down challenges designing games in 2024, 2025. What I think instead, or what I want to tack onto that partially is like designing games during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, I can't think of a harder time to have been designing games than during lockdown, and like, especially for print media.
Oh yeah. So I think it's because of COVID and because of it was a player challenge more so than a design challenge. We had more time than we had ever had before to design games. Mm-hmm. We just couldn't play them. And I think that's why we saw such a huge rise in duet and solo games. It's because it's like, okay, well, I am just hanging out with my partner, or I just have myself. But I still want to play games. What do I do? And the answer became, okay, well, instead of these requiring 4 to 6 players and to get together and sit around a table and all this other stuff, we just have 2-player and 1-player games that are starting to come out. And then people are like, oh, okay, well, now I want to record myself playing this game, and we're going to make it kind of more theatric, and it's still a solo game. So now they're doing podcasts with it. I think that transition happened during and because of COVID. And I was lucky in that when I first came on the scene was right around COVID from a designer standpoint. So mm-hmm. we've been designing since 2021. And so I kind of came in and was like, ooh, like solo games. And I'm still going to like do like Lasers and Feelings and Honey Heist and stuff like that, which are more traditional, smaller games. But also like, oh, what does a journaling game look like? How do you do solo play? How do you do duet play? One of our most well-known games is a duet game. And it was exactly that, right? I was sitting in a RV kitchenette, just kind of messing around and being like, I want a game where you can play with just 2 players. Designed a game where you could do that, right? What does that look like? And we had no idea. You had no idea what a 2-player game would look like beyond just kind of traditional, like, oh, one person's going to be the GM and one person will be the player. And that's how you do at a game. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, but what if it wasn't? How do you do that? And so looking into those different things, I think it's a very interesting time with COVID. Print games, I think we're fine. Come like 21, 22, like I think print games like started picking back up, especially as more people had already gotten into indie games because of the solo and duet piece. Mm-hmm. So I think from the perspective of like coming in through COVID, wasn't that it was easier. I just came in not knowing that there was a different way to do it. Right? Like
this is just how it is. Right.
This is just how it is, right? Yeah. Oh yeah, you self-publish and you do this and you use these tools and I don't need traditional publishing. And like, what do you mean you print here and that gets sent to a distributor and that goes to a retailer and you're doing this cut and this cut and this cut? That none of that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because I came in during COVID, right? So I look at a lot of publishers that had existed well before COVID, and they did struggle a little bit because they relied very heavily on in-game store sales and conventions and live play, like at table kind of things going on in order to promote and sell their book and stuff like that. And I didn't have that. I was like, all of my audience is on Twitter at the time, and now it's Blue Sky, and we're working with, you know, actual players, and I print and warehouse all of my own books, so I don't have to worry about warehouses shutting down at all. I do distribution to retailers, and I also work with Indie Press Revolution, who does distribution on my behalf as well. Which, and that's different than the traditional way of like, oh, well, I need a publisher. And that publisher is going to take, you know, whatever it is, 50, 60, 80% cut, and they're going to work with a distributor, and that's all opaque to me. Mm-hmm. That's what you would do kind of pre-COVID. And you would work on pitching, right? You would be like, okay, well, I have this game and I need to pitch it, and here's the selling points, and it's got to be 50,000 words long, or it's got to be this, and, you know, you're kind of working towards the publisher. That disappeared for the indie scene. You know, to get your books out there and on shelves, like physically on shelves, is so much easier now because of places like Indie Press Revolution, and then also stores are willing to, not like Barnes & Noble, but like stores are willing to come to your page and your storefront and say, hey, can I just buy from you wholesale direct? And you're like, yeah, that sounds great. They don't have to go to, you know, Penguin Books anymore. Mm-hmm. To get their books. And I think COVID really helped to change some of that.
It's a thing that I think a lot about is the ways that a lot of things changed through and after and because of COVID. And I think we're just getting to the other side enough of it to see some of the like finality of saying like, mm-hmm. this is a thing that has changed because of it. We have enough distance to say, you know, it's been long enough. This has changed because of this. And it felt like during COVID, at least for me, I'm not going to act like this is a universal statement, but it felt like for me that like a lot of the big publishers just stopped for a lot of reasons, a lot of logistical reasons. And then in that moment, just everyone exploded with games.
Yeah.
You know, it just everyone in that moment decided that they had a game and they were making it, and they were doing PDFs, and they were doing low, you know, they were doing small print runs on whatever. And it's so cool to see on the other side of it, now that it feels like everything is kind of rolling back how it is, to see that space filled in as much. And it's like, oh no, like, you know, you might have been worried that a lot of these people were going to go away or stop and whatever. And I'm sure people stopped just because like, I had a game and I thought about it and I did it and that's fine.
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
It feels like that space just allowed so many people to come out and flourish and make all kinds of whatever.
Yeah. I call us the class of 21.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge number of designers that kind of coming out of 2020, like into 2021, as we were all just kind of being like, well, this is our world now. A lot of us became game designers in some fashion. And we all kind of came on the scene at similar times and kind of worked with each other and started talking to each other a lot and founded communities together. And, hey, I'm doing this, and this is what I learned here, and this is how I'm doing packaging, or here's how I'm promoting with, you know, on itch.io and different stuff like that. And, that whole group of people, I call the class of 21. And, you know, some of them released their one game and they're like, that was good. I had fun time making art, but I don't want to do this as a business. And you're mm-hmm. like, that's great. Thank you for your contribution. That's amazing. And then a lot of other people have continued on and, you know, they're formal businesses now, which is great. So many people can make that dream work.
Yeah. And it felt like that gap allowed so many voices and styles and themes and things. Side note, hi, editor's note. I feel like a lot of people have difficulty discussing like positive outcomes of COVID. I think we're far enough away that we can discuss that some things changed for the better because of it. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of those things, like, because of a number of problems and bad times, there was this big gap, and it's incredible to look at everyone that started making so much to fill that gap. And man, I got real hot last episode just thinking about TTRPGs. Man, TTRPGs are good.
right? They're great. And there's just so many different styles and so many different ways to make them. But yeah, I do think that with the, like, being remote and being at home, and some people were laid off. So when I started Pandion, I was unemployed. And so you had this time. A lot of people were unemployed during COVID, which gave people time to sit and be like, okay, well, what do I do? I've applied to 30 jobs. Now what do I do with my day? And they're like, well, I'm interested in writing, right? And so they've written these different things. And I think, yeah, a lot of good has come from that effort of sitting down to write TTRPGs and start talking about them more and doing indie and not relying on a pitch to a publisher to get your ideas out in the world.
Right.
Right. I think that that's part of it, is we have more people going, I'm not asking permission of anybody to release this. I'm releasing it. Mm-hmm. I'm making it. Right. And then it gets made and it's fantastic and it's wonderful. So yeah, I agree.
So just two more questions, cause I don't want to take up a whole bunch of your time, but these two will probably take a little bit.
Okay.
So, you know, you mentioned Badger and Coyote, your duo game. Your last two games are what you call solo plus.
Yes.
And I'm kind of interested in your thoughts on solo games, your thoughts on solo plus, your thoughts on, you know, designing for that space, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So traditionally we have designed solo games as like journaling games. So like you sit down, you write what's happening. Maybe you roll some dice. Maybe you draw some cards. They take you to prompts, right? Table prompts. And then you're basically writing a story out. And that was how we've designed solo games. I mean, that's Whispers in the Walls. That's I believe that's kind of how Death of the Writer works, or Death of the Author works. Our Hints and Hijinks games, the solo ones, that's pretty much how they function as well. They're journaling games, and they're fantastic. But we wanted to kind of dig more into more open-ended gameplay, or gameplay that emulated actual like TTRPG space of games. But we wanted it to be designed for solo play at the start. And the solo plus comes into basically saying, yes, this can be played with a GM. It can be played, you know, GMless, it can be played duet. But it was designed first for solo. And whereas a lot of these games where it's like Mythic, like a GM emulator, right? Here's a multiplayer game that you happen to be able to play solo, as opposed to this is designed for solo that you can happen to play multiplayer, right, with a GM. And so to me, that's the difference between what we're doing with Solo Plus versus just solo support, is it's specifically designed for solo play. All of the rules and all of the mechanics and everything is really player facing. So there, you don't have to have a GM, or you don't have to have a GM emulator. Part of the play is the discovery of that solo person.
Well, and I don't have a ton of experience with solo games, but looking over the rules and you know, my experience with, you know, non-solo games, it feels like it's easier, or maybe easier is not the right word. It's simpler at the table to expand a solo game to include multiple players than it is to work backwards. That's a thing I've kind of been looking into the last couple years since COVID, trying to find a way to play TTRPGs with my partner, you know, speaking, you know, just two people stuck in a room. And you know, I found a couple of things that worked, and we figured some stuff out, and I was like, man, like, this is just kind of a pain. And so it's interesting to see the design decisions made to say, you can play this as a single person. You mentioned working with the soloist. And I think that makes more sense to start from the perspective of the solo player, and then say, and then also if you want somebody to be in charge of that, and if you want someone else to have another character.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's, I think, because once you design a game that has abilities and roles and resolution mechanics and stuff like that, that's designed specifically to support just one person sitting with the book, the game book, and a journal, and maybe their maps and, you know, notes. Mm-hmm. Adding people into that becomes pretty easy. We've even had people take some of our solo games, our solo journaling games, and they're like, "Yeah, we're doing this as a GM'd multiplayer game now." And I was like, "That's great! Like, it still uses the same core mechanics, but instead of writing about it solo, you have somebody describing what you would be writing down instead. That's your GM, right?" So yeah, I think it. I enjoy designing solo first, and in Midnight Muscadines, even our playing solo section isn't rule changes. It is, what is an inciting incident? How do you do narrative? What's a gameplay loop in order to help support you with going forward, right? Like, oh, what do I do next? Like, if you become lost, right? And so it's not a lot of solo support in TTRPGs, at least historically. I think that's going to change. Has been like, here's rule changes to make this friendly for solo play. Whereas I'm saying, this game's already mechanically friendly for solo play. Here's how you make stories, right? Here's basically how you become your own GM. And so I think that is a better way. I got to be real careful with that. All the ways are great.
Well,
but,
it's what's better for you, for your design, yes, idea. This is a thing that continues to come up, unsurprisingly, given these conversations, is there's no one perfect way. It's the way that works best for the design of the mechanics, the design of the narrative, the design goals you're trying to hit.
Well, and I think more specifically from the perspective of, you know, if you make a game that is solo by default, that's added multiplayer, you still want a solo section that talks to the solo player that says, hey, here's guidance, because you don't have a group of people to bounce ideas off of. You don't have, you know, a GM that just spent the last 3 weeks designing this big grandiose campaign to put in front of you. You have to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's hard. And that is part of the gameplay. But if you, you know, don't have that kind of guidance and nobody to bounce ideas off of, we've got to provide that in some way. And I learned that from publishing Substratum Protocol, because we were just like, here you go. Like, here's the game. Here's how you play. Here's some, like, how to play with a group solo, like a group solo. Like, you're managing the entire team. Have fun. And they're like, some of the feedback we got was, I'm having trouble starting. Where do I start? I need to get going. It sounds super interesting, but I don't know what to do. And I was like, okay, we need to provide guidance on building the beginning of your story and building your entry point and what's the incident that sets off the adventure and, you know, information like that that helps the solo player. The game itself is ready for them. We just need to help them craft the beginning of that story. And so that's kind of what we're doing now in Midnight Muscadines, is our entire solo section is, let's build you a story. Let's give you tools so when you do get stuck, you know, not with the mechanics, but with the story, here's what you can do to get the story moving again. Here's permission to, if there's a lull in your storytelling, you don't have to slog through it. Jump ahead, right? Things like that. I'm very excited about, actually. I'm really excited about several pieces of the solo section for people to go explore.
And that's, excuse me, that's just good, you know, that's just good advice anyway. You know, regardless if you're playing as a solo game, a multiplayer game, if you go on to play something else, excuse me, it's great to just kind of have that in the book. Because some people need it to be in the book and need it to say, you can skip the boring part. It's okay. Right. Yeah. If you're not having fun, it's okay. You can just get there. And that's great, because sometimes you do just need to skip the boring part and don't let yourself get bogged down. Get to the fun part. Get to what you want to be doing.
Yep. Exactly.
And that's just good advice.
Yeah. The hard part from a design perspective is sometimes we only have 12 pages, right? And going in and saying, hey, here's a solo game that's 12 pages long, and then here's your 36-page supplemental guide that tells you how to build a story, you know, that gets kind of difficult. But, you know, I'm lucky in that I'm able to say, this book can be as long as it needs to be. I don't have a hard page limit. I know that I can get this printed. I know that I can deliver this, whether it's, you know, 100 pages or 250 pages. So I can spend the word count in the numbers to really flesh out that aspect of the game.
I like the idea of releasing a game that's just 2 pages long. And then mm-hmm. the rest of the like 20 something page book is just like narrative advice of like, how to craft a story. That could be great. And it's not even like that's a bad idea. That would find an audience. I just like the idea of being like, yeah, there's like a 1 page in the front, and then the rest of it is just like, you know, basic storytelling narrative techniques.
That's actually a really great idea. I kind of do that with like the rule summary that I try to put together for every game. It's just like, just print out this page front and back. You have everything you need to just play the game. It's right there. And you're done. You don't need to read further than this. And then if you need clarity, then dive into the book. That's when we go into detail and handle edge cases and if then this, then that kind of nonsense that you have to really focus on as a game designer when you get crazy rules that you want to put together. But just from a summary perspective, I always, always, always try to get a rule summary put together that's like, here's 2 pages. This is the entire game. Have fun. The rest of this book is to support you.
That's a big thing that I think TTRPGs could take from board games is mm-hmm. being able to just like, I have the rule book and just like flip to the back and it's like, okay, so during your turn, what we got to do is we got to do the upkeep and then you do your action and then we refresh the market and then it's your turn.
Bullet point list. Yep.
Yeah. And it's like, exactly. I know what those things are. I just have to remember this is the order we do them in. And then, okay, hang on. Do you take your card and then hang on. Flip. Yep. Yes. Okay.
And the thing is for me, I like having that rule summary at the very beginning of the book because that gives me like the 30,000 foot overview of mm-hmm. the game. She's like, okay, here's 2 pages. I can have it all literally laid out in front of me. When you say, you know, when you talk about protection in one of the terms, I don't have to be like, well, where's protection in the book? And I go through and I'm flipping through 30 pages. I'm like, but what's protection? Mm-hmm. It's right there. It's like, oh, okay, this next bullet point down is protection. It is X. And then if I want to know more details about the intricacies of protection, I can go into the actual section that talks about it in depth. But I know like Heart, by Rowan, Rook, and Deckard, I went through the whole book and I was like, this is really cool, man. I wish they really had a summary guide. It's in the very back of the book. It's the last page of the book. And I was like, I needed this at the beginning. Right? Because I was just like, what is this? Okay, this isn't clicking right now, but I'm just going to keep reading. And it's a fantastic book and it's a fantastic game. I just am the sort of person that wants like all of the terms on one page so I can like visually just be like, okay, this all connects together. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Now I'll dive in.
A good index, a good glossary, or like, you know, reference. Yep. They go a long way. They go a long way. I'm famous for yelling about Morkborg not having a table of contents. And like a lot of people are like, well, it's because it's whatever. And I'm like, it's also bad. So
We need a table of contents. In my opinion, that's basic accessibility too. I mean, you just gotta.
Yeah. There's a whole conversation we had, but that was the sticking point for me. I was like, I'm trying to read this. I'm getting through it. I'm trying to find a thing, and this is making it more difficult than it needs to be.
I had to pick up their what is it? I think they call it like the naked version or something like that.
The plain text version.
Plain text, yeah, basically the plain text version. Because my brain won't let me read the actual book.
Mm-hmm.
I can't read it. I can't absorb that information. I have to go to the plain text version. So I appreciate that they released that, because mm-hmm. the other one's a great art book.
I think there's a fantastic conversation to be had, and I know I've chatted with my buddies a good bit about it, of games as an art, books as an art artifact, and you know, what is the sort of deciding factor between art versus usability versus whatever. And yeah, there's a huge conversation about it, as yep. the answer that I'll say. They released a plain text version, and God love them for it. But so this is the last question. This has been a thing that I did kind of spur of the moment for the first episode, and I've just kept doing it, and it's been great. It's fun because I think it's fun. And it's been fun every time. And if you're not making fun for yourself, what are you doing? Sure. So this is the three question. Andy, I ask everybody a question about three, and it's, you know, what three, whatever. And so, Andy, what are your three favorite things to put jam on?
Oh, to put jam on.
Yeah. I initially wrote down three favorite flavors of jam, and I went, no, that's too easy.
Yeah.
Let's try harder.
Well, the easy one, we'll just go ahead and get it out of the way, is toast.
Sure.
You know, jam Classic. On toast, it's wonderful. We'll do it on bread, too. That's all lumped into one. I do like jam on eggs.
I hope that this came up. Jam on eggs.
Yeah, jam on eggs is really good.
You get a good jam.
And if you do jelly jam on eggs, it turns your eggs green, and that's how you have green eggs and ham, is actually by putting jelly on them,
mm-hmm.
Which is phenomenal. Let me see, what's the last thing I like to do? I used to, now I haven't done this in a little bit, but I used to put a little bit of jam or jelly in my milk to steam it into a latte.
I haven't heard of this. That's an interesting idea.
Yeah, so I'd use that as like the sugar, like a simple syrup.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of using a simple syrup, I would take like a tablespoon or a half a tablespoon of jelly, whether that's jelly or strawberry or mango or whatever, right? And I would drop that in, and I'd stir it up in the milk, and then I'd froth the milk up. It was pretty good.
That's an interesting idea. I haven't heard of this before.
Yeah, it doesn't, like, the milk won't get very, it doesn't get like super velvety, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you do, right? Because it's just too much stuff. So if you use like a marmalade, don't use a marmalade. It'll just be like, there's just too much in there. It's, you know, it gets a little bit of that sweetness. You get some of the, like, if you're doing like a mango, you'll pick up just, it's very faint. It's pretty good. It's pretty good. So I recommend people trying like a jelly latte.
I'm gonna have to try this now. I'm gonna have to.
Yeah.
And
it takes a little bit of tweaking.
I'm annoyed at how quickly you were able to come up with three. I thought the last two were gonna get you a little hard. Damn.
I exist on jelly. It's fine. In life, I like peanut butter and jelly. It's all day, every day.
I think a lot of people underrate a really good jelly or jam. You get a really nice one with like, you know, nice piece of bread.
Yep. Oh yeah.
You can do a lot.
I love like charcuterie boards too, and some days I'm just like, you know what, I don't need that much cheese, but I do want all the spreads.
Mm-hmm.
Give me the jellies and the jams and the marmalades and the honey and the mustard, and I'm just gonna put it on all of the crunchy toast that you just gave me.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's what I'm here for.
I love this.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Where of a
yeah, that one went by pretty quick. I was like, oh, I actually have this figured out.
You were way more ready for that than I expected. Because, like, okay, he's going to say toast, obviously.
Yep.
Obviously, it's going to be toast, and we're going to move past it. But
yep. I'm trying to think if I have a fourth just really to put it out there. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't think I do.
I think people put jelly on pork sometimes. I feel like I've seen.
Yeah, like especially to like do a caramelization, like they'll like brush it on or put it on. Cranberry sauce does not count as a jelly, in my opinion. It is, but it's not.
No, it's a because if you said, do you want some jelly, and you gave me cranberry sauce, no, that's not the conversation we were having.
But I do love red pepper jelly.
We had that not that long ago, and I've been thinking about getting some more.
It's really good. Like, the first time I was like, that's weird. You don't put those two things together. And I had it and I was like, I need a gallon of this in my house at all times. Right.
It was almost the same conversation. We had it for some reason. We were making it with something, and I was like, I don't know how I'm going to feel about this. That's great. Yep. I need that all the time.
Right. So it's actually really interesting. There was a conversation very similar to this when we were talking about Midnight Muscadines, because the magic is basically you have a jam jar and you add ingredients to the jam jar, mm-hmm. and it makes a magical jam, and that's how you cast spells. And if you want to cast a different spell, you have to modify your jam. And we were just talking, like, and it's just like all sorts of different plants and herbs and stuff like that. And at one point they were like, shouldn't it just all be fruits? And I was like, no.
No.
I was like, and like, I have a little snippet in there, and I have a feeling a lot of players will probably just kind of skip over this part. But the way that we canonically cast spells in Midnight Muscadine is you eat a little bit of the jam, and then you can do one casting. And so each time you cast, you're tasting your jam. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the question then comes up is, like, man, if you start putting things in there like fur or, you know, other ingredients to be like, oh, I wonder what this will do, right? Because we have a whole section on, like, using untested ingredients of, like, flora and fauna and stuff like that. And it's like, well, what happens if you put, like, mushroom and dog fur and, you know, strawberry in there, basically, right? You make that, and then every time you cast this spell, which will probably be fairly powerful and pretty interesting, you have to taste it. What does it taste like? Please describe that to me, right? But yeah, because of, like, pepper jelly and some of these other, like, interesting jellies and jams that I've seen around, I was like, no. It you can put anything you want in this jar, and it becomes part of the magical spell, but you do have to taste it.
And so that it goes back to that fun interaction between the narrative and the mechanical of, like, okay, yeah, you can have this really powerful spell. You will have to tell me what strawberry dog fur tastes like.
Right, you exactly.
Start thinking about that now. Just start roll. It's gonna come up, so you better.
It's a little chalky, full of fiber. It's like Metamucil, right?
Yeah. But that's gonna be it, Andy. Thank you so much for coming on. This came together very quickly, so I was glad we were both able to make time. You're moving.
Yeah, it's great.
So thank you so much for making the time for that. I appreciate the heck out of you.
Yeah, not a problem.
But yeah, for
come on.
Before I sign off, I'll give you another little second little outro for, you know, where people can find you, what's going on. Midnight Muscadine is coming to crowdfunding. Is it Kickstarter, BackerKit? Coming to BackerKit in April, I believe you said.
Yes, that's right. And you can always get to the campaign or wherever it is, going to pandiangames.com/muscadines. That will always take you to whatever the latest page is, whether that's the landing page or the backer page or the pre-order store, wherever. That will always take you there. But you can find all the rest of our stuff at pandiangames.com or pandiangames.itch.io. We usually have sales going on at any given time. And then you can follow us on all the socials at pandiangames. That is us everywhere.
Heck yeah. And as always, I meant to say it at the top, but I'll say it here. All the links to everything will be in the show notes. All of Andy's links, all Pandian Games, everything awesome. We talk about is in the show notes. So if you're curious about something we talked about, it's in there. Go check it out. But fantastic. that's where we're gonna leave you, Andy. Thank you again so much. Say bye, everybody.
Thanks. Have a good one.
And that's it. Another episode of What You Doin' Podcast in the bag. I'm recording this in the calm before the storm. I have 4 interviews scheduled over the next 6 days. I am really reaching out to people to talk about their zine month projects. And the response has been absolutely amazing. People are so excited to talk to y'all about their games. And I hope you're excited to hear about them. I hope you go check them out. I hope you back any that you can. And as always, let them know that you heard the interview here on What You Doin'. Now, as always, the links to everything will be in the show notes. You want to check out Andy's socials. You want to check out Pandion Games website. Go to the store. Go buy some stuff. You want links to the crowdfunding page so you can pre-save it so you know when it goes live. All of that will be in the show notes. Social links for me, social links for the show, all that good stuff. As always, if you have feedback, stuff you want to hear, stuff you don't like, stuff you want to add, feedback@mattcalder.com. I'd love to hear from you. Please review the show wherever you can. It helps us in the ratings and it helps more people see the show, I think. If you want to be on the show, there's a link in the show notes. You can fill out the contact form. I'd love to talk to you about whatever cool thing that you're making. If you're excited about the show and you want to support, $5 over on Patreon gets you the video versions of our episodes and any bonus episodes that come up. Right now, it's just the single file version of episode 3. But anytime something pops up, it'll pop up over on Patreon. And if you've already supported over there, thank you so, so much. And even if you didn't, thank you so, so much for listening. Thank you for getting this far. Thank you for checking out this episode with Andy. Thank you for checking out any other episodes. The episodes have been seeing really good numbers. It's been very excited to see people excited about, I mean, I guess the show, but mostly the projects. I want people to be excited about the things that I'm talking to people about. This podcast is merely the vehicle to get it to you. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.